as repairmen for the radar sets, and we had, I think it was 6 months, 3 months or 6 months, I forget now, at Wanderers Technical College in London, where we took mathematics and physics. And then we went to the actual radar school for another three months, I guess it was. And you learned how to service the sets. And
were they very complex at that time? Or?
Oh yeah, they're very extremely complex.
Are they finicky at all? I mean, do you have to have them just set just so, or...?
Calibration, the British sets were pretty rugged, and they would stand. One of the big problems we had was in, I guess it was in 43, we started getting Canadian sets over, which were far more accurate. But the thing is, if a bomb went off within a quarter of a mile of them, the calibration would be so upset that you couldn't recalibrate them for 6 months. They just weren't practical, and eventually they got rid of them and went back to the British sets.
I don't understand the calibration business. Could you explain?
Oh, well, it's...
for the layman, maybe.
Well, the sets essentially consists of a transmitter, which transmits a burst of radio waves, maybe 6 microseconds long at a frequency. Well, the early sets are about 56, 58 megacycles, and the Canadian sets, they used a different system. They used a, what they call a magnetron, it's an oscillator, and they would go up to about 100, I think about 120, again, it's a long time ago, about 120 megacycles, I think. Well, you had to be able to control the length of the pulse, the shape of the pulse, which was sent out from the transmitter. You wanted to as narrow a beam and as concentrated a beam as possible. You didn't want a wide beam.
Mm-hmm.
Then at the time that the pulse was sent out from the transmitter, there was a locking device into the receiver which started a time base on the cathode ray tube. And then when the reflected pulse came back from the plane to the receiver, this was applied to the time base would be XY. Anyway, it was applied to the top of the time base. As the time base was going across the tube, it would start at the time that the pulse went out from the transmitter, and then as the pulse was received back at the receiver, it would pull the time base up, and the distance out from the start of the time base to where the pulse was put up, half that distance would be the distance away from the plane. And obviously it's calibrating the time base. There's a tremendous number of things could go wrong.
So it didn't take too much of a jar or whatever to...
Well, with the British sets it did. The British sets were extremely good.
They weren't quite as accurate, but they were much more
useful in the sense
heavy-duty battle.
Heavy-duty, yes. And they say the after, I guess it was 6 months experience with Canadian sets, we went back to the British. Canadian sets were just not useful.
Well, what would happen with the concussion? Just throw the whole thing out of whack?
Yeah, just throw the whole thing out of whack. It was all vacuum tubes. There were no transistors at that time.
Right.
And it was much easier for the thing to be thrown out of whack.
You just couldn't reset them, or
well, that's what we were doing. Yes, that's what
you were attempting to reset.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they wouldn't reset worth a damn either.
The Canadian sets wouldn't know. With the British sets, you could usually get them back in action in a couple of days.
Very interesting. Take a break here for a second. We're back. We'll go back into some early training. You didn't pick up flocks of geese and mistake them for airplanes at the time? Or?
No, I don't think that ever happened. But we did have problems, particularly in the London area, where you're a fairly high-density building, and you had to identify church towers because they would appear on the radar
Well, how would it appear? I know today's like radar. You get almost a map type thing. Visual image. This isn't the case then, is that right?
No. All you had two tubes, one for bearing, one for elevation. The antennas they were split so that the idea was that the whole cabin in which the radar set was inside, this would turn, and when you got an equal signal on each of your two antennas, it means that you are on target, and you could tell by the varying heights where you matched the heights of the pips on the time base, cathode ray time base. When those two are equal height, it meant that you're on target. If you wandered off, it means that you would be a stronger signal coming from your right antenna than from your left antenna, and it would pull the time base higher.
So this is how you
higher.
Zeroed in? Well, how did that relate to the gun? Then was the gun extremely accurate? Do you figure?
This information was fed electrically through mag slip transmission to the predictor, and then the various corrections for temperature, wind, air temperature, charge temperature were fed into the predictor, and then the corrected information was fed right to the guns.
And how long would this process take?
It'll be instantaneous. Continuous feed all the time.
Mm-hmm.
As the radar set turned, so the information would be fed into the predictor, indicating change in bearing, change in elevation. This would be corrected by the people on the predictor, and that would be fed into the guns. So it would go, at the speed of electricity, 180,000 miles per second, instantaneous.
Well, then, did planes fall out of the sky at this point, then?
No, because your accuracy, I'm trying to think what the accuracy was. Maybe, again, it would, of course, depend on range. Extreme range would be about 30,000 feet, I suppose. And at that distance, you might have an accuracy of 100, 200 yards. All the shells, of course, were fused. They have to be fused because the idea wasn't to hit the plane. The idea was to have the shell explode close to the plane.
Mm-hmm.
And the gunners on the guns had the responsibility of setting the fuses, and they would set it for a particular range.
The idea then for you guys, as you said, to consider it a success is to get these guys to drop early, or to get them so high that they just spread all over. And that would be considered a successful operation on your part.
It'll be more successful if you actually hit
the
bugger.
You see any planes come tumbling down?
Oh yeah, I've seen them.
What's that like?
Well, it's exciting. I remember the biggest excitement was to see who could get out there and get the propeller off the plane to bring back to the workshop to make rings and little ornaments out of it.
Was it just falling out of the sky? Is it screaming down?
It would come down in smoke.
Would the falling plane do more damage than the bombs?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that there was a tremendous amount of damage done from falling planes. I don't know of any. Probably there was, but I don't know.
On the early use of the radar, though, your gun crews knew that you were radar controlled.
Mm-hmm.
But they had tight security as well as you had tight security, is that right? Were they kept under a tight security?
Not really. The actual site itself, the gun site itself was not it was reasonable security, but certainly nothing like the radar.
Well, did everyone figure out you had radar rather quickly, or was it the big secret of the war, or what?
Oh, everybody knew we had it. You couldn't hide a radar set. They were big. The span of the antenna would be probably 16 feet. And then usually there was a chicken wire net around the set, which acted to give you a sort of a plane surface for a certain distance out from the set, so you wouldn't get reflections from the local topography. So you couldn't hide a radar set. No way.
What was it? It was a big secret cabinet inside, or cabin that you crawled into? Is that the thing? Or
yeah, I suppose it would be about half the size of this room.
Which would be?
I don't know. Say about 6 feet wide by about 8 feet, maybe 9 feet long. The set itself would take, at least half that. And then there were seats for the guy on the turning the thing to turn the cabin around.
By hand or what?
Yeah.
This would be a hand winch type turner by hand.
You just, there were just two handles, and then you had your radar bearing scope right in front of you, and you just turned these handles to follow the pips so that you got equal pips.
So the whole cabin moved.
The whole cabin moved,
as opposed to the antennas moving.
Well, the antenna was attached right to the cabin.
Well, why wouldn't they hook up the antennas to move? Or is it just too radical a development, or what?
Do you have the antennas move separately?
Well, have the antennas move and leave the cabin where it is, or is that just not feasible at that time?
Well, I don't really see any advantage to it. You're going to have somebody turning antennas anyway. They have to have a cathode ray tube in front of them to know how to turn them. So it would really be no advantage. And then, of course, the man in the transmitter also had the bearing and elevation so that he could aim the transmitter in the right direction.
So you had one guy shooting the signal and three receiving,
yeah.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, so you'd have a guy turning the antenna, or turning the cabin, I should say.
And then the other would work the elevation.
Another fellow would work the elevation.
Yeah.
And then there'd be one more?
There'd be another person in there, yeah, usually. Because you couldn't
catch all, or
no, you used to rotate. I mean, if you had a raid for 4 or 5 hours, after about an hour, you need some relief from watching a tube.
Would it burn your eyes out, or what?
It's fairly demanding, you know. It would hurt your eyes, but the fact is you have to concentrate every second that you're there, because there's a lot of guns depending on what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. How long were you with the British Army in this endeavor then?
I guess I was with them up until about the end of 43, I think it was. And at the end of 43, this was the time the V-1s were just about finished, if I remember rightly. I may not. And the V-2s hadn't started. And at that time, my wife had been very sick. And she was working at Canadian Military Headquarters in London. And so I transferred from radar into Canadian Military Headquarters.
Did you come across, before we get there, did you have anything with the V-1 itself, buzz bomb the...
Oh, yes. We had lots of experience with V-1s.
Did they show up in the tube differently, or...?
Very, very difficult to catch, and they went very, very fast.
A lot
of them were pick-a-back launched. In other words, they were launched from an aircraft, and tried to pick up the aircraft. Some, again, were launched from the other side, and they were virtually almost impossible to pick up. They came in fairly low, too low to be picked up by radar.
I've done some reading on that, and it seems that the Spitz and the Hurricanes, whatever, would try and get their wings up there and tip them off.
Psychologically, I think the V-1s were by far the worst, because you could hear them coming in, you could hear them cut off, and you had no idea where they're going to come down. We had a house, we were running a house on the North Circular Road, and one landed just around the corner from us. We heard it coming, we didn't know where it was going to land, and we lost all our ceilings and windows and everything.
What about the V-2? No,
V-2 did a lot of damage, but in psychological effect, virtually none. Because if you heard them go off, you knew you were all right. If you didn't hear them, you were dead, sort of thing.
Didn't hear the bullet that kills you.
That's right.
Type of.
Yeah.
Well, the thing with the V1 or the V2 though is there's nothing. All the prediction in the world wasn't going to change.
No, you couldn't do anything with those.
They were ballistic missiles. They were coming down like yesterday.
Yeah. And say you know the explosive damage by the V2s was very very high, but psychological damage was very, I would say, very low.
Was that V1 the pulse jet? They make a distinct sound, I guess, also with the pulse jet.
Oh yes, yeah. You could.
You knew exactly what it was.
Yeah, you could. But then see, they always cut off.
Yeah.
And you may have 2 to 3, maybe 2 minutes before they landed, and you didn't know where they would land.
So you transferred out. Your wife was sick. So you transferred out to Canadian Military Headquarters. Now, what was your rank at this point, and did you finally get your promotion?
I reverted to gunner again to get the transfer.
You reverted back to a gunner. Yeah. What were you? What were you with the British Army then?
I was a Lance Bombardier.
That would be what, a Lance Corporal here?
Well, it would be a Lance Bombardier. They don't have corporals in the artillery, or at least they didn't.
Excuse me.
You talked about the senior service, you see.
The senior service, the artillery. The depths of my ignorance. So you reverted back to a gunner.
Yes. During the whole time that we were with the British Army, we had absolutely no contact with the Canadian Army, and there were no promotions, no nothing for that whole time. And then when the first Canadian radio location unit was formed, and all the Canadians were brought back into the rest camp at Borden, and then there were big decisions about what was going to happen. They were going to save the world by through Canadian radar, and I think in a period of about 2 weeks we were formally put with signals, we were put with ordnance, we were put with service corps. Nobody knew what we were. And then eventually some of us went down to the south coast for a few months to service the gun sites along the south coast. This was at the time when they were getting a lot of low-level bombing coming in.
Now this would be radar-controlled guns as well?
Oh yes, right? Yeah. It was a radar workshop on the south coast. And then I went from there into CMHQ in London, back into London.
What was your actual duties at Canadian Military Headquarters in London?
I was with printing and stationery.
I'm sorry?
Printing and stationery. I operated a process camera.
And so what was the kind of thing you were doing?
Oh, all printing for the Canadian Army. Everything. From airmail forms to arms manuals, everything.
So that was the closest cartography you've gotten since
yeah.
since you initially joined up.
Yeah.
And then how long were you doing this for?
I came back in 46.
And you stayed, 46. You stayed in London?
Yeah.
And worked with the Canadian Army?
Mm-hmm.
Now, did you get a promotion there?
No.
No? You remained a gunner, is that right?
I remained a gunner. Yeah.
Until 46?
Yeah.
Then what, then you mustered out in 46?
I came back in, I guess it was in February 46. Got discharged in Winnipeg.
And then you made mood maps, is that the deal?
Oh God, no, that's many, many years later than that. No, I went back to the company I was working with before I joined up. And we used to do a lot of provincial government mapping there, and a lot of calendar work, a lot of beer label work, a lot of food label work. And I stayed with them until about 51. And then somebody that I met in the army from Ontario, who was the son of a very large, son of the owner of a very large printing company in Ontario, we decided that things looked pretty bright for opening a plate-making place in Windsor. We had a contract with Ford of Canada for all their work. So we opened this place and did quite well for like 4 years. And then Ford of Canada arbitrarily closed their printing plant down and moved all their offices to Oakville. And we sold out to one of the local people. And I went to the States.
Well, when did you do your university then?
I went to university, eventually I went to Seattle, and the company that I was working for there, they did all the cartographic work for the University of Washington. And I got to know the people in the geography department at the University of Washington quite well, and they kept saying, well, why don't you come back? Why don't you go to night school? Come back to school. So I started taking night classes for about 3 years. And then they got a contract from the Boeing Corporation to build a model of the moon for the training of astronauts. And they asked me if I would like to go to the university to work on this model, and in that way I'd be able to take classes. And I did that. The contract for the moon model was satisfactorily completed in about, I think, about 18 months. And then I got another research contract with USGS to do some low-level aeronautical charts, and that provided me some another year's money.
And then you did what?
And I got my BA, and then they asked me to stay for my PhD. And I worked for a year with the Russian and Far Eastern Institute doing transportation maps for Han Dynasty China, and that provided me with sufficient money to survive for a little while longer. And then the Economic Development Administration, through one of the people in the economics department, managed to get enough money to go for a year's work in Ireland on economic development, which resulted in my dissertation.
Very good. You didn't hit the Canadian forces up for your education, is what I'm trying to get at.
No, probably very damn silly not to, but the company that I was working for offered me a very, very good deal. They were an excellent company to work for. And I guess I used all the available money that I had coming from the services to buy a house, furniture, and that sort of thing. Probably a very foolish thing to do in retrospect. But I suppose it's worked out all right. In the long run.
In the long run, it always works out.
Yeah.
It comes out in the wash. Well, that sounds very good. Thank you very much.
You're entirely welcome.
Thanks, Dick.